Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the secret bombing of Libya by warplanes from Egypt and the United Arab Emirates that caught US officials by surprise, and speak with Ali Abdellatif Ameda, the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England and author of The Banking of Modern Libya. We will discuss Libya's descent into chaos following the ousting of the dictator Gaddafi by the US and NATO, and the capture of Tripoli's main airport by ultra-conservative Islamists, and the patchwork of warring factions involving various Islamic groups, a renegade general, and tribal militias that all suggest Libya is in for a long civil war. Then we'll look into the extent to which the latest assault on Gaza by Israel has eroded their public support in the US, and whether AIPAC, the Israel lobby, which has been undermining Obama's Middle East policy, is losing influence. Lisa Goldman, the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative at the New America Foundation and the co-founder and contributing editor to 972mag.com, a progressive digital magazine based in Tel Aviv, Jaffa, joins us to discuss recent polling by Gallup that finds only one quarter of Americans under the age of 30 thought Israel's actions in Gaza were justified. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Ali Alyami, the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. He joins us to discuss Tuesday's meeting in Saudi Arabia between Iran's deputy foreign minister and Saudi officials, and whether the two countries who are fighting a cold war in the region have decided their proxies are getting out of hand. We will also discuss the routine beheading that goes on in Saudi Arabia that ISIL or the Islamic State are copying, and Saudi responsibility for the emergence of Al-Qaeda, ISIL, Boko Haram, and Al-Shabaab, and the spread of radical Islam around the world. And joining us now is Ali Abdellatif Ameda, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya, and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Abdellatif Ameda.
Thank you, Ian.
And events in Libya are, I guess, probably the last thing the Obama administration wants to hear about, and certainly Hillary Clinton in terms of her presidential ambitions, given that the U.S. Liberated Libya and then sort of walked away, and now it's all coming back to haunt us. And my understanding is that the mystery jets that have been bombing the airport in Tripoli that's been taken over by the Islamist rebels, those jets are coming from Egypt and the United Arab Emirates, and apparently they've caught the United States by surprise.
Yes, there is indeed some confusion about who is behind it. But Libya is now becoming an arena for regional competition and regional alliances. And in the absence of a strong central government, in the absence of something I try to advocate for a long time, which is meeting to include everybody and agree on minimal peaceful existence among all the rivals that toppled the old regime, and in the absence of resolving, you know, and having some truth and reconciliation, Libya is now is an arena for alliances such as the Saudi and the United Arab Emirates on one hand, and Turkey, and also Qatar and Turkey on the other hand, and the non-government organizations, jihadists and Salafist groups, who are trying to impose their own will, and also strong cities like the city of Misrata and its allies, who try to really compensate for the loss of the most recent election. So Libya is an arena for local groups who haven't really reached any sense of compromise, and also regional alliances. And in the background, I would say that the Obama administration should take some responsibility for the mess that exists in Libya now.
So what's your sense then, if the Egyptian Air Force are already bombing the rebels, the Islamist rebels who've taken over the airport in Tripoli, will that mean that Egyptian military boots on the ground will follow? Because my understanding is that it's not just Egypt that's been considering military intervention in Libya. Also, Tunisia has as well.
The Tunisian and the Egyptian government are very nervous now. Libya is now a place where there is no central government. There are all kind of armed groups, including extremists and jihadist groups and Muslim Brother militant groups who were defeated in Egypt, and they are really are opposing the Sisi government in Cairo. The Tunisians are very nervous because even though they have a very fairly better transitional coalition and more stability, they also have groups and pockets in the north west of the country where Islamist militants are targeting the regime there. And Libya, with its huge borders on both sides, is a big headache and could be a huge threat if these militant groups, Muslim Brothers and jihadist international organization from all kind of walks of life, they become really strong in Libya. This is could be a destabilizing event, and they are really nervous right now.
So what can we make of the renegade former general Khalifa Haftar, who is, I guess, the face of, what would that be, the secular opposition that is fighting the Islamist insurgents, who largely come from the east but now have taken the airport in Tripoli and look as though they're on the move? What's happening with General Haftar and his forces?
Well, I think, as you know, one friend told me in Libya, said, you know, if there is no General Haftar, there will be, we'll create one, meaning that he's really the deterioration of the situation in Libya, created a climate where people say anybody who will bring stability, we're going to support. And General Haftar, who is a very, very controversial figure, as we spoke last time, you and I, about him, he became the product of this really desperate search for stability and for security for ordinary, you know, people and daily life in Libya. I don't think a lot of people will agree on him, but people thought that he will fight these militant, uncompromising brigades and groups. And I think at the beginning there was a lot of support for him among some segments of the so-called liberal, because there is no such thing as completely secular. I think most Libyans will be either liberal persuasion or modernist persuasion. So at the beginning he got some support from the old army, from the air force, and the I think in the regionally he got support from, you know, Egypt and also United Arab Emirates and other groups who want some stability in Libya. Turkey, on the other hand, and Qatar supported Misrata and the Islamists, especially the Muslim Brothers. So I think General Haftar at the beginning had some momentum going on for him, but I have to say people were really eager to see results, and he hasn't fared very well, because in Benghazi the Ansar al-Sharia and the militant groups managed to defeat his forces, and also in Tripoli we know that the airport unfortunately was destroyed, and the Misrata groups and their Islamist groups allies took over the airport. So I think the general and his soldiers and the air force are not faring well right now. Now, it doesn't mean that situation might change, but I see danger in getting involved, regional involvement, if the Egyptian and the United Arab Emirates intervene militarily. Unless one is very careful, that could really fuel more a full-fledged civil war.
So the face of the Islamists, at least in Tripoli, who've taken over the airport, their commander is Salabadi, who's apparently an ultra-conservative Islamist. He's a former parliamentarian, I guess, from Misrata. And then you mentioned the other Ansar al-Sharia, the hardline Islamic group. So let's figure out this, because you have both internal and external forces. You have al-Sisi, the general in Egypt, who's obviously concerned and leading and sending his jet fighters in to bomb the Islamists in Libya and may well send in troops. And yet he is supported, el-Sisi, by the Saudis. The Saudis, on the one hand, have been the ones that have been exporting the Salafi ultra-conservative Wahhabi doctrine, which has inspired a lot of these Islamists. So it's as though the Saudis are fighting on both sides.
Ian, you're quite right. The Saudi are playing a double game. In one sense, their schools, their preachers, their money, and are really geared toward allowing the conservative Wahhabi clergy and its institutions to operate through the Hajj, the pilgrimage to numerous mosques worldwide, and through also recruiting young people coming to the holy places in Western Arabia. At the same time, they don't want the violence committed against them and their own security. So they play really a double game. In one sense, they say we are really for against extremism, but their clergy and their part of their elite and institution is really the center and the nest for Wahhabi activities that led to the rise of this very isolated way of thinking in Islam, very much fringe thinking. And from that, fringes came Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And after that, all these Salafi, hardcore, really brutal groups that mushrooming in other, into other organizations, North Africa and other places. And they really are against the mainstream Muslim traditions and practices in not only in the Middle East, but also in North Africa as well, including Libya. So, yes, there is this double policy. And unfortunately now, the Saudi government, on one hand, and the United Arab Emirates are supporting certain groups, non-Muslim brothers, that the Turkish government, especially the current government now, Qatar are supporting other groups, and Iran supporting Syria and the Shia government in Iraq. So we have axes that are using the Arab Spring as an arena to settle their scores and also defeat their rivals. It's a really huge mess. And who's losing here? The ordinary people who vote, who fought against all these dictatorial regimes. And now they see themselves are really losing not only their security, but stability. And they see themselves as the Libyan people really in an anguished situation.
So this Salabadi, who's the leader of the conservative Islamists who've taken over the airport in Tripoli, he's with the Muslim Brotherhood, right?
Yes, he is, and he belongs to the city of Misrata, which is the third largest city. And the city of Misrata has a peculiar situation. It's unintended result of the war against Gaddafi's regime, where Misrata got all the aid, all the arms through the export from other parts of Libya and from Europe and also from the Middle East and so. And suddenly, with the defeat of the Gaddafi regime, they found themselves as one of the most, equipped and armed cities in the whole country. And therefore, they began to flex their muscles on the elected Congress, and they are very eager to impose a prime minister from that city. When they really failed to do that, because in the most recent election for the parliament, then they began to target their rivals as counter-revolutionaries. And I think the trigger to the whole thing that really led to this more recent conflict is the fact the Islamists lost in the election out of 200 elected seats. The Islamists got, I think, around 17 seats. So this is almost a reaction in the absence of any dialogue or compromise between different factions.
So, Ali Abdellatif Amida, tell us then about the other level. We've got the external players like Egypt, Tunisia, and Qatar, Egypt supporting, I guess, General Haftar, the Turks and Qatar supporting the Muslim Brotherhood fundamentalists who've taken the airport. But there's also another layer, is there not, of the tribes and the Zintanis fighting against the Islamists. And then you've got the Berbers and the Circassians and those tribes of Turkish ancestry are like the Maseratis. So who's fighting who and how do they line up with these external foreign sponsors?
Well, it's a very peculiar, I think, right now, because there is no central government and society is reverting to the basic towns and reviving kinship organization and alliances. It's very, very sad. It's also, I think, it's misleading in a way because Libyan society is very, very much literate and urban and integrated in a modern economy. But because the absence of the central government became so severe, people are reviving these alliances to just mobilize support in their fight for power. The what we see is very interesting. I'm a student of Libyan social history, and I have been writing there for 30 years. Revival of old alliances that existed during the colonial period. So coastal cities split between the Islamists and also the regional interests like Masrata again is the interior. So you'll find the Zintan and the Jabal being, Western Jabal being split and other groups who try to fight for it. To me, this is really interesting because it revived old alliances that existed before. The Islamists are not a dominant force, but they are very well equipped, and I think the city of Masrata, not necessarily, even though it's allied with the Islamists, they are really hungry. The leaders of the armed groups, they're hungry for power because they want to have a prime minister, they want to have some seats in the government, and they want to really cash in what they think is the gains of the uprising against Gaddafi. On the eastern side of Libya, you find the Islamists are in control because of not of their number, because of their, again, the same thing, ideological organization, arms and also discipline. The city of Derna is controlled completely by them, and they even, they are aligning themselves with Al-Qaeda. But the second city of Libya, Benghazi, is controlled at least certain neighborhoods by Ansar al-Sharia. And except that in Benghazi, the public opinion, the civilian, civil society, activists, lawyers, women organizations, students, intellectuals, they have been really courageous in trying to condemn any armed groups. And this hasn't been resolved. And also add to this, really the sad thing, Libya didn't have any good leadership after the uprising that brings people together instead of the idea of grabbing for power, arms, and money. And the sad thing is nobody has emerged to say, this is, let's sit on the table, let's bring all groups, and let's have a peaceful transition where we agree on four or three goals. And let's disagree about everything else, but let's resolve that through peaceful means and through the ballot and through election. That hasn't existed. Tunisia did that. The Libyan, I think, a coalition that fought against the regime failed to do this. And in my opinion, this is really the original sin. And I would say even Egypt, has to confront that sooner or later in the future.
But it sounds like, just in closing, Ali Abdellatif Hamida, that the tragedy here is that after the Libyan uprising, you basically had a majority of Libyans who are educated, urban, and who are religious but not extremists. They have no representation. The parliamentary elections made that clear. The Islamists, as you said, got about 17 seats. So what they didn't win electorally, now they're trying to win at the out of the barrel of a gun. And that the silent majority, the moderate Libyans, have just nowhere to go and no representation.
Exactly, and I think that's why they refuse to accept the election, and they wanna go around it to impose their own will on the public opinion, which is a tragedy, after all, for everybody.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I'm speaking then with Ali Abdellatif Ameeda, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya, and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the extent to which the latest assault on Gaza by Israel has eroded their public support in the United States. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lisa Goldman, who's the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative at the New America Foundation. She has lived and worked for over a decade in the Middle East, covering Israel, Palestine, and the immediate region, including the 2006 Israel-Lebanon conflict and the 2011 Egyptian uprising. Her analysis of the Israeli media's coverage of the 2009 invasion of Gaza received an International Journalism Award for conflict reporting, and her byline has been published in a wide variety of European and North American media outlets. She's the co-founder and contributing editor to 972.com or 972mag.com, a progressive digital magazine that is based in Tel Aviv, Jaffa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Goldman.
Thank you for having me.
And there's a very extensive article in the article in the New Yorker, Friends of Israel, the lobbying group AIPAC, has consistently fought the Obama administration on policy. Is it now losing influence? That suggests that the lobbying group AIPAC, loosely known as the Israel lobby, which has consistently fought the Obama administration on its Middle East policy, is now losing influence. I assume they mean because of Gaza.
Well, there has been some shift in the Jewish community regarding this sort of uncritical loyalty to Israel, which was always sort of across the board within the organized Jewish community, from the liberal left part of the Jewish community through to the far right. There is a shift amongst the liberal left, which tends to be actually the majority of Jews. Like, most Jews in America are Democrats. I think 73% voted for Obama, maybe more. And that's been consistent for a very long time. But AIPAC, you know, it still has a lot of political power that's not really representative of the Jewish community. In other words, you know, it carries, it, like most lobbies, it's very good at working the system on Capitol Hill, and it involved in fundraising and so forth. And also, it's very important to note that AIPAC has quite a strong wing of evangelical Christians. And the evangelical Christians do tend sometimes to be a driving force in AIPAC policy as well. It's part of their religion, of course, to be unstintingly loyal to the idea of Israel as a home for the Jews. So AIPAC itself doesn't really represent the opinions of the center and center left of the organized Jewish community, but it still, I think, holds a lot of political power, and I don't think that's changed.
Well, an example of the political power is that when the Senate went into recess in August, because of gridlock, they hadn't passed a bunch of bills, one of which was extending or reauthorizing funding for the Iron Dome, the anti-missile defense system that the Israelis had developed with U.S. taxpayer money. And that was all but considered dead. But Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, and Harry Reid, and Senator Tim Kaine, and Republicans John McCain and Lindsey Graham all came back to the Senate and had it passed. And in his photo opportunity after having passed this piece of legislation that AIPAC was pushing to fund the Iron Dome, Lindsey Graham said, not only are we going to give you more missiles, we're going to be a better friend. We're going to fight for you in the International Court of Public Opinion. We're going to fight for you in the United Nations. That particular fight that Lindsey Graham's talking about is not going well for Israel anywhere else but in the United States, is it, in terms of public opinion?
No, well, it's not even going that well in the United States right now, I think. But, I mean, Lindsey Graham can grandstand as much as wants, but there are some issues here about, first of all, Iron Dome is a very easy sell because it's not an aggressive weapon. It's a defensive shield. What it does is when rockets come, approach from Gaza, approach Israeli urban centers, the Iron Dome shoots something up into the air that meets the rocket and explodes it in midair before it can land. So it's a very easy sell as a defensive weapon, and it's not something that's obviously used to attack Gaza, which is something completely different. I mean, the funding for that is a bit different. There are some cracks, I think, you can see it in the mainstream media in Israel. There is some evidence that the opinion about Israel is shifting a bit, that it's not as wholly uncritical. And here I'm not speaking only of the Jewish community in America. I'm speaking about the population as a whole. You can see, for example, the New York Times, which is obviously the most important newspaper in North America. It's been featuring some highly critical op-eds written by Jews and by Palestinians, several written by Palestinians, which is also quite unusual, using words like colonialism that were just sort of taboo maybe just 4 or 5 years ago. I do think that because this is the third time Israel has launched a major military campaign against Gaza in less than 6 years, and the destruction is so heavy, and the civilian casualties are so numerous, especially children. And this time there's a very, very strong international media presence in Gaza. So, you can sort of compare it to the way American public opinion was influenced by those nightly images coming out of Vietnam in the 60s. And I think this time also these very powerful images of, tons of destruction of buildings, piles of rubble, homeless people, hospital emergency rooms, dead children. I do think that these images are having some effect on mainstream opinion about Israel. It's no longer so universally uncritical as it used to be.
So in terms of what you were just saying, Lisa Goldman, a Gallup poll in late July found that only a quarter of Americans under the age of 30 thought the Israeli actions in Gaza were justified. And presumably that number has gone down because far worse destruction has happened since late July, and it continues to this day. So there is obviously a tremendous disconnect there, isn't there, between the American people and their representatives influenced by AIPAC?
Well, yes, I mean, there is. And I think that we'll see some more shifting as people in their 20s and 30s start to take their place in the establishment and become more politically active, however that political activism may take its form. Gaza may be a tipping point, and I have been saying this, I've been testing this theory of mine that Gaza is a tipping point on quite a few people, and journalists and commentators and analysts, and so far nobody has challenged me on that. Most people do tend to agree that Gaza is a tipping point, and it remains to be seen how that's going to manifest itself in terms of policy and opinion. But I do agree with you that people in their 20s and up until their late 30s, they're definitely asking a lot of questions. Jewish people 45 and above tend to have been raised with this idea of Israel as an insurance policy against anti-Semitism, against policies that are anti-Jewish in various countries. And I think that this younger generation feels much more comfortable and secure and less in need of this sort of insurance policy. And I also think that it's really important to note that American Jews, whatever their age, they do tend to be very American. You know, when they vote on issues that everyone else votes on. They don't vote on Israel. They vote on, you know, taxes and schools and so forth. And they're also not thrilled to see articles like the one that was recently published in the Wall Street Journal that showed how the Netanyahu's office had been sort of systematically undermining Secretary Kerry and the Obama White House in a very devious, roundabout way. And this, you know, for Americans, this, there's no dual loyalty here. I mean, Israel is very important to them, but they're not going to be pleased to see the Prime Minister of Israel circumvent the policy of the American government.
Well, but there isn't an American, in effect, as Israel's ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, who grew up with a political family in Miami. He worked in the 1990s for the Republican consultant Frank Luntz and helped shape Newt Gingrich's contract with America. Then he emigrated to Israel, worked for the Jerusalem Post, became close to Netanyahu, and Netanyahu has now made him the ambassador to Washington.
Yeah,
it's pretty extraordinary there, and he's very partisan, as clearly Netanyahu is. So is AIPAC, AIPAC always had tremendous traction in the Democratic Party, and that they sort of, I think Shamir figured that they should go after the evangelicals as a way to get an anchor in the Republican Party. But now it seems that, if anything, AIPAC is more dominant in the Republican Party than it is on the Democratic side. And I wonder what kind of calculus that is on Israel's part. Do they think that somehow the Republicans are going to be running this country forever?
Well, that's a funny thing to say. I don't know, but I would look at it like this. Netanyahu surrounded himself with American-born Jews, and the ambassador prior to Ron Dermer was Michael Oren, who's also American-born and raised, used to teach at Princeton. He's a well-known historian. These people represent the small number of Republican, you know, the relatively small percentage of Jews in America who vote Republican and who are, you know, or who are oriented more toward the Republican Party. And Netanyahu has for years surrounded himself with this small clique of right-leaning American-born Jews who, by the way, had to give up their American citizenship in order to serve in the Israeli government. So Ron Dermer no longer has an American passport, nor does Michael Oren. But I think that what these guys have done, like people like Oren and Dermer, is that they've given Netanyahu a false sense of security. They're so American, and they have their finger on the pulse of the American popular mood. And I think that they've miscalculated and that they're detached. And they've been too long in the prime minister's, you know, they've been too long at the pinnacles of power, you know, working the system, and really they no longer really have their finger on the pulse of the American Jewish community. And it's quite easy, I think, to keep on sort of reaffirming that sense, giving yourself a false sense that you're still in touch with how people are thinking in the American Jewish community. Because if you go to certain, you know, give your talks at certain suburban Jewish centers or synagogues, people do tend to be very receptive when a representative of the Israeli government comes to speak. That doesn't mean that they agree with their policies, though. They may be proud of Israel or proud that these American boys have done good in Israel, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll support the policies that they espouse.
So do you think that America will go the way of Europe in terms, because, you know, Europe and I remember working as a journalist in France and England in the 60s, when Europe was incredibly pro-Israel, and so the French in particular. They'd, after all, helped them with their nuclear program and provided them with all of the Mirage jets, etc. But it's totally different today. So do you think it's that there is something inexorable about this situation? As Israel itself goes more and more to the right, it seems that its support in the rest of Europe has gone away, and it's starting to erode here in the United States.
I think that popular support again amongst younger people, is starting to I don't know if the word is a road, but let's use it anyhow. It's not as strong or as impenetrable as it used to be, and I think that trend is set to continue. I don't think that America is, in the medium term at least, going to shift as radically as Europe did between the late 60s and present time. If you look at European, especially European post-war history, you'll see that they do, especially in Western Europe, you see these really, really radical pendulum shifts between the far right and the far left in voting patterns in countries like, you know, not so much in the UK perhaps, although Margaret Thatcher might be an exception, but in countries like Germany and Italy and France and Spain. So people, and also, you know, the Holocaust plays a certain role in influencing how people perceive events. So while there might be very strong public anger in Europe that some say is mostly driven by North African immigrants against Israel, you'll also see that the EU is not really taking a very strong position vis-a-vis Israel. They might huff and puff a little bit about settlement products and labeling settlement products, but they haven't actually done anything. In fact, they've been quite supportive of Israel. Now, America tends to be, they don't have the same historical baggage as Europe does, and also it tends to be a very, very centrist country. So I don't really see any rapid or radical shifts in opinion toward Israel in America, among, you know, in public opinion. But what I do see is a very steady shift in the public opinion that reflects people, what people are saying to me. You know, people in their 30s are highly educated. People in their 30s are saying to me, I have a lot of questions. I'm no longer as comfortable as I used to be with being unstintingly or blindly supportive of Israel. That seems to be a, you know, broadly shared opinion. And I think if Israel, if the current government continues in its policies, or which could very well happen if the next government, the one that replaces Netanyahu, who, by the way, is sliding in the polls. He polled it now at 38% popularity, down from 83% last month. So the next government could be even more right-wing, which would further widen the gap between American Jews and Israelis. And so I think that right now what we're seeing is Israel more or less heading further right and American Jews heading further left. But I don't think this will be a radical pendulum swing in amongst American Jews. I think it will be steady but slow.
Well, Lisa Goldman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Goldman, who's the director of the Israel-Palestine Initiative at the New America Foundation. She has lived and worked for over a decade in the Middle East, covering Israel-Palestine and the immediate region, including the 2006 Israel-Lebanon conflict and the 2011 Egyptian uprising. Her analysis of the Israeli media's coverage of the 2009 invasion of Gaza received an International Journalism Award for conflict reporting, and she's the co-founder and contributing editor of 972. That's 972mag.com, a progressive digital magazine that is based in Tel Aviv, Jaffa. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether Saudi Arabia is responsible for the emergence of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Boko Haram, and Al-Shabaab, and the spread of radical Islam around the world. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who is the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, he has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reform in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you.
And on Tuesday, Iran's deputy foreign minister is visiting Saudi Arabia, and apparently both Iran and Tehran and Riyadh, Saudi Arabia and Iran, are both happy with the change of government in Iraq with the removal of Nouri al-Maliki. Is there any possibility, since there's a kind of Cold War or a surrogate war going on in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia and Iran, do you think there's a possibility that the two sides have realized things have got out of hand, particularly with the Islamic State running amok in the center of Iraq?
Well, I'm sure that there are many issues that made these two absolute regimes very worry in terms of what's happening in the region as a whole. But one thing people have really to understand, your listeners and others have to understand, that the regime in Iran and the regime in Saudi Arabia have more in common than you see on the surface or you hear them talk about on the surface. They are both absolute theocratic regimes. And neither of them would like to see democracy. That's why they are both trying their very best to make sure democracy does not take hold in any part of the Middle East. And Iraq is a good example because both of them have been supporting extremists in Iraq. So they have more in common than they do talk about or pronounce and announce to the public, their public, both the Iranian public and the Saudi public. So yes, their interest is to keep the status quo in the Middle East in their favors, and that means finding ways to keep regimes that share their political and religious and strategic values, which means absolute dictatorship in the Middle East. Neither of them would like to see democracy in any part of the Middle East.
Well, but arguably Iran, it may be run by the Revolutionary Guards and the Quds Force and the vigilante police, the Basij militia, but it does have elections. You certainly don't have elections in Saudi Arabia. You don't have a parliament. You don't have anything. You've just got the royal family.
Absolutely right. I mean, the Iranians, even though it's a theocratic regime, their political system is superior to that of Saudi Arabia. They have elections. Women's rights are more respected in Iran. And people have voices through the Iranian Majlis or parliament. So, yes, there's no question. That's fact of life. Anybody could tell you that.
So let's talk about the op-ed that appeared in Saturday's New York Times by Ed Hussein, Saudis Must Stop Exporting Extremism. I thought it was a very welcome piece because so little is heard about Saudi Arabia's, the nature of what they do around the world. And the United States has always been a kind of slavish ally. And no matter how often and how much Saudi Arabia stabs America in the back, we seem to keep talking about them as a great ally. But I thought this piece by Ed Hussein really exploded some of the myths and pointed out some of the more obvious stuff, which is that as much as we are in horror of what is happening with the Islamic State or ISIS in the Middle East, and particularly with the beheading of an American journalist by a British ISIS terrorist, that the article points out that beheadings happen regularly in Saudi Arabia.
Yes, the only thing that's new about this, the only thing that's actually new about Ed Hussein's article is the fact that it was published in one of the most major sort of liberal U.S. Newspaper, and that's the New York Times. I think that's admirable. It's good that the New York Times is actually is taking that route, because they are sheepish too in terms of the Saudis, just like the rest of the main media in this country. We have been seeing all these things for the last 20 years. We have this CDHR, the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, was actually founded to expose the Saudi extremist, religious extremist exportation of the Saudi lethal ideology, Wahhabism, and the Saudi financing of extremist and terrorist groups all over the world. So I'm glad the New York Times actually have published something like that. That's great. Now, beheading, you are right. The Saudis have, in two weeks before the beheading of the American journalist, the Saudis in 2 weeks beheaded 19 people. 19. So this is, beheading is a way of life in Saudi Arabia, especially in Saudi Arabia. And that's where these extremists and terrorists learn their trade. They learn it from the best. They see it happens in Saudi Arabia regularly. Saudi Arabia is the birthplace of Islam and home to holiest shrines. So they see these things happen in Saudi Arabia, and it's actually where they get their education from the Saudi government policies.
So tell me then about the nature of how it is that Islam, as Ed Hussein pointed out, that there were liberal traditions in Mecca and Medina that have basically been silenced by this 270-year-old tribal pact between the House of Saud and the founder of Wahhabism. And we can later talk about the terrible effect of spreading radicalism around the world through Wahhabi mosques. But specifically, just explain in the context of Islam how this religion sort of took this very dark turn, starting with the Wahhabis.
Well, you know, first of all, Mecca and Medina, prior to the establishment of Islam and 14 centuries ago, It was actually Mecca and Medina were inhabited by Jews, Christians, and pagans. That's what the Arabian Peninsula was before Islam came in. So, and there were cemeteries and historical buildings and pre-Islam, and this and the Wahhabis in the 1920s came and demolished all of the pre-Islamic cultures. And then start cleansing, religious cleansing. Hijaz, that's where Mecca and Medina is, in the Hijaz region, that's western Saudi Arabia, by the Red Sea. That area had been very liberal, and it used to be ruled by the Sharif of Mecca, who was kicked by the British and sent to Jordan and Iraq in the 1920s and 30s. So it was very liberal region, even though the Holy Lands are there, but the area as a whole are very liberal then, and they are still the most liberal part of Saudi Arabia. The Wahhabis' ideology is cultural and religious cleansing. Anything that is not Wahhabis, they destroy, including the place where Prophet Muhammad was supposed to have been born and raised. They destroy that too. So what he's saying is very true, and that's what we have been saying for many, many, many years. I'm writing a piece as we talk, actually, that most Muslims hate this Wahhabi movement, the Saudi Wahhabi movement, and their absolute religious dogma. And they want to see an end to it, especially the young generation, especially women. They want modernity. They want freedom of expression. They want social life. And the Wahhabis are against all of that. So what he's saying is very true, that Mecca and Medina was not at all an Islam in itself. I'm not a religious expert, to be honest with you. But what he's saying is very true about Islam before the Wahhabis took over. And the many Muslims who are not very fond of the Saudi Wahhabi dogma.
So the King Abdullah is supposedly maybe recognizes some of what you've been talking about, and he'd like to have a more open kingdom, if you will. But my understanding is that the arrangement that the House of Saud has with the Wahhabis essentially is the basis of their control. The one family, the Al Sauds, control everything financially, politically, and the Wahhabis control everybody's minds and hearts and bodies through this religious oppression. So if the religious police are out there trying to police making sure that you dress properly and you live according to this very austere code, you don't have any time for political rebellion or even political thoughts. And that's the whole idea, that there's just no politics. It's kind of the same vision that Putin has in Russia, you know, that just forget about politics. I control everything. Well, in Saudi Arabia, it seems that the Al Sauds are saying, forget about politics. We control everything, and religion is your only outlet. So is this a bit, let me use an analogy here in terms of trying to modernize Saudi Arabia from the point of view of the king. Is it a bit like having a kind of pit bull that then grows up and it keeps everybody at bay, but eventually it gets so big and powerful that it could turn on its owner and bite them?
First of all, I think it's a misrepresentation of the truth to think that King Abdullah is a modernizer and also political reformer. I think, and that's one thing. The other thing is that it's important to understand that the only legitimacy for the Saudi royal family is the religious establishment. So they are not going to live without them. They just want them to be more controlled by the royal family. There is a competition between the religious establishment as a whole and the ruling family itself. And the Saudi regime want to have the upper hand, and that's what King Abdullah is actually trying to achieve. It's not because he's a political reformer. I mean, they have absolutely no choice but to make some kind of cosmetic reforms like voting, so women will can't vote in the coming municipal election. But voting on what? There have been municipal election. There have been voting, but the people who got elected, they have never been given any assignment. So it's for global consumption, this, you know, King Abdullah's reform. But these two families, the Saudi royal family and the Al-Sheikh family, or the descendant of this Abdul Wahhab, the founder of Wahhabism, they just cannot live without each other as much as they hate each other. And they actually do. But they cannot, neither of them could survive without the other. So the whole argument that King Abdullah is trying to rein on these people, the religious establishment, is very true, but for reasons other than what the Saudi public relations are paid to say and do, and some of the media, and the two families cannot live without each other. The Saudi regime have no other legitimacy other than this being the custodian of Islam. So the arrangement between two of the families is what keeps them all in power. And if one of them is goes, the other one goes. And they both understand that.
So just in terms of what the U.S. can do, in terms of their continually pushing the delusion that the Saudi Arabia is an ally of the United States when so often they stab the U.S. in the back, the Saudis just donated $100 million to the United Nations to fund a counterterrorism agency, at the same time that they are spreading this Salafism and this xenophobic, austere, and often violent form of Islam around the world. So on the one hand, they're giving money to the UN to counter terrorism. On the other hand, they help create Al-Qaeda. They've helped create the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, all of these violent Sunni Salafi organizations around the world. When are they going to be held to account?
They should be held to account. They should have been held to account long, long time ago, because what that article states, and if I would definitely, if I may say this, I will definitely encourage your audience to go and look at our website, www.cdhr.info. Because you have written about these things, and information is there. Saudi Arabia should have been accountable for what you mentioned, the bad deeds of supporting, creating extremists and exporting their ideology and supporting I mean, financing them. I'm not saying it. You are not saying it. Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, this is documented. It's even, you know, I quote this all the time. And you could find it in the web, internet. She was quoted as saying Saudi Arabia remains to be the major exporter of ideology and financier of extremists and terrorists worldwide. This is the Secretary of State. So we are not, you and I are not just creating something that doesn't exist. It's a fact of life. The Saudis should be held accountable, and they could be held accountable. Our problem in this country is that they have hired so many people, and they are spending so much money, like the $60 billion arm deal, for example. They hire the highest officials in our government after they retire to represent their interests, like former FBI Fritz represent the interest of Prince Bandar in this country, the former Saudi ambassador. They hire generals. They hire politicians. The problem is not just the Saudis. In fact, the Saudis are doing what's in their best interest. Our problem here is our people in this country, in America, who sell themselves to the Saudi ruling family to represent their interest, including promoting the Saudi ideology. There are so many Islamic centers at Harvard, Berkeley, California, Columbia, Stanford, you name it, and those Georgetown University is famous for this. They are promoting the Saudi religious interest in this country. So it's not just the Saudis that we should be pointing finger at. It's actually our own public relation groups, lawyers. I mean, most of the famous law firms in this country represent the Saudi interest and promote their interest. So it is a mess, but the Saudi should be held accountable, and they can be held accountable. And I agree with that article and what you have been saying, that without going after the root causes of the problem, you are not going to be able to eliminate terrorism. And the root causes of the problem is the Saudi ideology and their finances of extremists and terrorists worldwide. You can't kill one person, but then 100 can be produced, and we have seen this. We have bombed Al Qaeda. We have killed Bin Laden. Al Qaeda disappeared. On the contrary, the Islamist extremist murderous groups are on the rise all over, and Muslims are actually the biggest victim of these groups. But now it is not going to be confined to the Muslim world. You mentioned earlier that the American journalist, who is a courageous man, who was beheaded, he was actually beheaded by a British citizen, not by a Saudi citizen, but British citizen. So it is going beyond the Middle East, and believe me, unless it is stopped, it will get worse before it gets better.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Ali Al-Yami.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. He's a native of Saudi Arabia and has lived in the United States for many years, where he's advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.